You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Who Watches the Watchers? I'm Data Logan from Bremerton, Washington.
I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. So we go back to season two and we look for Data Logan again. And that would be up the long ladder. So you've been on, you haven't been on since a few shows last season. So how you been since February?
Well, yeah, things are going great. Just bought a brand new vehicle. You know, it's always interesting adjusting to a new vehicle. It's like getting into a new shuttlecraft with new little Whammerdine gadgets. Yeah, so it's fun.
Does it get good dilithium crystal per mile? Or something like that. And does it get good matter-antimatter mixture mileage rates?
I'm sure it's fair. Yeah.
I assume engine efficiency is at 97% once Geordi was taking care of it.
I look at the economics of maintenance, but I mean, to be fair, I probably don't buy it for gas mileage and do other things, other cool things.
You don't have to pull into a star base for repairs too often?
Yeah. No, not too often, yeah.
Does it still have that new shuttle smell?
Yeah, the kids will probably break it of that pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah, I always try to, when you get a new vehicle, try and keep them out of there for a while, but it doesn't last very long.
Well, the biggest thing is do not ever let them use the food slot. Food slot, get it? Anyway.
The coolest thing about this new vehicle we have is that it's got the radar-assisted cruise control. So,
really? You
know, typical cruise control maintains your speed, but this, with the radar assist, it will slow you down if there's a vehicle in front of you going slower than you want to go.
Oh.
Automatically, so you don't have to come out of your cruise control. It's pretty cool.
Okay. Well, what they need to come up with next is a way to avoid the driver who's had too much synthahol.
Well, don't they? Not in Nebraska. I guess it's New Mexico where they have self-driving cars already, right?
Oh, my goodness. I think it's such a bad idea. It is a terrible, terrible idea because there's just too many unknowns. The kid who jumps out in the street.
I guess you'll talk about that later when you get to Booby Trap, right? The pros and cons of turning it over the control to the computer.
Maybe, but it makes no sense to me. Anyway. Okay, so what have you done lately? Have you been on any other shows?
No. I think your show was the last show I was on. I did a long... I don't know if you guys listened to... what is the name of that show? Star Trek Companion? I don't know if you guys listened to that podcast. Mm-mm. I did a
no,
long...
I don't know what.
I recorded a long audio for them where they had reviewed Dear Doctor and they all thought it was a good episode. And I recorded like a half hour discussion about why I thought it was a bad episode. And then they aired about 40 seconds of my discussion.
Oh, sweet.
So, whatever.
Believe me, I've had that happen to me.
Whatever.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I've had that happen. Even on a podcast that I was actually a guest on, that happened to me.
I have been
that hurt.
I have been in the forums a lot on the new Upper Pylon 2 podcast, and some of that's been mentioned on the show, of course. So,
what's that? Oh, really? Upper Pylon 2. I wanted to bring that up again because they are doing awesome, man. They had a discussion. This is a complete sidetrack, and I apologize, but they had a discussion on Babel. Do you guys remember Babel?
Babel.
Tomato and tomato. Do you guys... Okay, so if you remember it, then obviously you know what it is, where DS9 crew starts talking wacky.
Yeah, I think Babel was one of the best episodes of this first season of DS9, with the obvious exception that you have to like pull Duet out as being kind of outstanding for the entire run of the show. But I really enjoy Babel for some reason. I don't quite know why, and I remember getting the VHSs with DS9 as they were being released in the UK, so I never watched it on TV first. As a result, there was sometimes gaps in the release schedule, and as a result, I think a lot of the early DS9 that I like, like I'm a big fan of things like Distant Voices and Visionary, and I'm a big fan of Babel. I also like the three-parter at the beginning of season two. I think some of this comes down to the fact that there was a little bit of a drought in the release schedule, and I just watched them more and more and more and more, and I kind of got into them. But I have a real soft spot for Babel.
Yes. Well, I mean, they've got some pretty smart people on that show. And one of the points they brought up, I'm sure you heard, but if you haven't, guys, you must check this show out, is they never had two of the aphasic. Is that what it's called? Aphasic?
Yeah.
They didn't have two of them talk to each other, because it had been interesting to see how do they hear each other. And then the question was how do you know for sure which patient is bad? Because they're, Miles is talking, all of a sudden he starts talking gibberish. Well, how does Bashir know for sure it's Miles? He just assumes it's Miles. It actually could be him. He could be hearing it wrong. And so those were some very good points. And I brought up one in the forum that I took it even a step further. If we get two people who are aphasic talking to each other, trying to determine what's wrong with these other people, then you'd have both sides working to try and fix the other side. So it had been interesting to see how that stalemate ended, who would have eventually won. If it wasn't for the death part of it, where you would eventually die, I say let everyone in Starfleet become aphasic, because if they could talk to each other, no one will ever know what the hell they're saying. So,
yeah, shouldn't the universal translators be able to figure it out eventually? No, actually, aphasia doesn't work that way. It's random every time, so there's no consistency. But,
right.
The upper pylon guys, they did mention how it doesn't really make sense in that episode, once people become aphasic, that they just stop working the problem. There's many other ways to communicate besides written word or voice, right? Should still be able to mime and just talk to each other or get some. So it makes a good point how there should have still been involvement from the aphasic characters more. Instead of just putting them in a room and saying, you're useless
I have to say, I do really enjoy it. I mean, I haven't seen the episode for a long, long time, and I don't recall which character it is. I think it's O'Brien, but it probably isn't, that actually goes to a pad and tries to write it down, and it still comes out as gibberish. That was at least an acknowledgement that it wasn't just a verbal issue. And I did like that. And of course, one of the great scenes in the episode is he said, "You money, give me," when Quark's in the infirmary trying to make sure that no one's bluffing their way out of paying their dues.
Well, then I said, I think you could figure out which one was aphasic because of the fact that they always have that confused look on their face after they've said what they've said. So, and I don't remember what. I'm going to look that up, actually. I thought it was kind of funny. My example.
Yeah, you should be able to figure out that you're aphasic, because even the very words your own words sound like gobbledygook to yourself, because you're doubly aphasic, right? The words are coming out wrong, and you're hearing them wrong. So I think you should be able to figure out that you're aphasic pretty quickly. Whereas if the other person in the room talking said something, right? If you don't talk and you just hear something wrong, it could be either you or the other person. But as soon as you talk, you'll know, oh, it's me. I'm aphasia.
Right, but, you know, we never... What had been interesting is, in the end, when they solved the problem, they said, you know, what were you thinking when you were saying what you were saying? Because in their brain, I want to say that there's, I feel fine. What's wrong with you? When I say, you know, shuttlecraft, space dock, transporter room. I had to come up with that on the fly, by the way. But anyway, the question I said that... the real question would have been, what does O'Brien hear when Bashir is asking if he's all right? Bashir might ask, Miles, are you okay? For all we know, O'Brien might have heard, check the mouse trap for pizza. So, and they never also, explored it from O'Brien's perspective talking to Bashir. But it seems like they're always confused when they say what they've said. They go, you know, what the hell did I say that for? That's how you know they're aphasic, but still. Anyway, long tangent, guys, sorry, but check out the Upper Pylon 2. It's an absolute must that you do. So who watches the Watchers? Let's go ahead, and I forgot to press enter on the Skype call, so go ahead, Data.
The synopsis for tonight's show is, the Enterprise must undo the damage when a primitive civilization discovers a Federation observation team and concludes that the Starfleet personnel are gods. This is the fourth episode of the season 3 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is October 16, 1989. Written by Richard Manning and Hans Beimler. Directed by Robert Wymer. Guest stars include Catherine Leah Scott as Nuria, Ray Wise as Liko, James Green as Baron, Pamela Seagal as Oji, John McClane as Finto. So, what do we think about this episode? I really enjoy it. I like one of the first really solid episodes. What do you guys think?
I agree. I think it's a very excellent episode. I like first contact with the alien species, especially ones that seem logical and nice. They're not trying to kill us at the start. But, of course, we end up screwing them forever. And we'll talk about that because... I don't think that when the Enterprise left orbit that they're okay. Well, they're not going to live their lives going, well, that was certainly interesting. No, I think they're screwed forever, and we'll get into why. What about you, James?
So screwed forever in this episode when first contact?
Yeah, I know. I'm saying that the species, the Mentakans,
okay.
I think they're screwed forever.
Oh, no.
I mean, there's going to be a lot of repercussions based on this.
I respectfully disagree. I really enjoyed this episode. I liked, you know, doing this show, right? You have an impression of which episodes you really like and which ones you think are good. And I used to think that this one was a good episode, but, you know, rewatching and, you know, making sure that I, you know, take notice and stuff like that. Actually, I really enjoyed this episode, and it's kind of gone up a notch in my mind. So I've always been, you know, I'm a big fan of season 3. In particular, I think it's really when they start delivering the excellent shows. But I think this is a very good story, and I've mentioned this before, and I know it's a really bad thing to say, but it's a story that really, I would be hard pressed to think that anything other than Star Trek would do. And I know that the prime directive there, and that is a kind of like a Star Trek, you know, isolate that and just consider this as a, you know, what effect do, you know, does an advanced civilization have on a primitive one? I can't think of anything else on prime time that would be delivering this kind of message in the late 80s. So I really enjoy it.
Oh, yeah. I think it's a great episode. Don't get me wrong. I love this episode. And it's a great story. It was good acting. And the guest stars, I mean, they were truly excellent. I'm just saying, in a real life situation, what we just did to these people, even though it was by accident, but we still did something to these people because, like you said, Picard says, I'm going to show how the magic works. Well, these people didn't know that magic exists until now. And another thing is I'll give away some of my secret sauce. The only of this entire planet We're only one extended family. And that's what she says, extended families. Only this extended family knows of this situation. All of the rest of the world has no knowledge of this. And so when Nuria and her clan start talking about the travelers from the stars, how many people are going to think they're absolutely nuts? I mean, now we're going to get into sides of this where some of our Data, what's that area? Area 51? Some people believe it's where UFOs landed and they're still there, and some people don't. It becomes a massive conspiracy type thing, and the government's suppressing it all. Well, what's going to happen when the Mintaken government wants to suppress all knowledge of aliens that came from somewhere because it doesn't fit the general belief? And that's why I say we could have holy wars now coming from this, because some of their clan is still going to believe that Picard is a god. Hey, I understand he says he's not a god, but I have to believe he is. You don't believe that any of this ever happened. And like I said, it changed their society. But at the worst, I think it screwed them. Because who would have thought of space travel until now?
Well, I think we all agree on the range, right? Learning about people from outside your planet changes you. And the question is, how much does it change you? But I tend to believe, and I think James is more along the line with me, that this particular development, you know, what happened on this planet, is not really that big a deal. It's not going to be a horrible impact. It's not going to cause holy wars. And I'm sure we'll get into that a lot more as we go along. But for the most part, I think it's a pretty benign interaction. But obviously it does change people to suddenly realize that you're a small part in the universe and that there's other beings and that kind of thing.
Well, I think the worst thing that they did was they took him off the planet. Once they put her in the observation lounge and she's watching her world from the stars, that took her to a point where, you know, none of them have ever conceived of this idea before, and now they know it can happen, which puts them way along on the evolution scale before they should have. And we don't know how they're going to handle the idea of space travel when they finally get out there. What are they going to do when the Pakleds and encounter them? They may or may not be ready for that. So
that's still centuries down the road, if not more. And plus, like you alluded to, the Mintaken government. There is no Mintaken government. This is a feudal society, or not even a feudal society. It's Bronze Age. It's, you know, a bunch of clans living on the land, and maybe a little bit of agriculture. But, you know, there's no authority above this clan. They run into other clans. They're all equals. So one clan, one group of people believe a certain thing, and they have experiences. You know, it's very possible this will all just be lost in time. Even if they do write it down, you know, it could just become the legend of Gilgamesh. You know, it's just like, oh well, those people believe that, nobody else does.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say that I do agree with Data on this, and I do think that the whole experience of the kind of that the village suffers is benign. And I think it's a combination, and I think Data is correct in highlighting, it's a combination of them being kind of like a small village, small extended family, I suppose, which confines the problem and doesn't allow kind of propagation of Chinese whispers, as, you know, people hear something on the grapevine and then very soon people start thinking about conspiracy theories and you know, other people in the government trying to put them down, etc., etc. But also, I think that I think they chose proto-Vulcans for a reason, and I think one of the reasons was that they were able to be, you know, reasoned with, and they were able to kind of like logically deduce. And you see it with you know, the scenes with Nuria and Picard on the Enterprise. Picard takes, you know, a logical argument to its conclusion when they start speaking about how a bow would be considered as magic from someone in the past. Now, you know that Nuria's culture doesn't have, you know, evidence or concrete evidence to suggest that that they've mapped out their evolutionary line, or they know where they've been, and they don't have the histories or that a modern day civilization would have of where their society has grown up from and developed from. But you can see her accepting the reason, and she mentions on numerous occasions that, you know, yes, that would be a consistent, or that would be a valid proposition. And I am minded to believe that these kind of people would be not too badly affected by this. I would imagine a lot of writers would love the idea of being able to come back to this planet in 100 years' time and you know, effectively pick up the story. But in my mind, I reckon this disappears after a generation or two, and no harm's done. That's how I read it.
Yeah, I think the use... Well, you alluded to them being proto-Vulcan, right? Mm-hmm. I just want to talk about that for a little bit. I mean, it's really a misnomer. In the Star Trek universe... If a race actually evolved to be like the Vulcans, they would be crazy at this point. I mean, the Vulcans at this point in their development were not logical. That was a fairly recent thing. Vulcans were very emotional and very primitive. You know, they fought a lot. They would be having wars. They still believed in metaphysical, supernatural things. So it's actually sort of out of place to use the term proto-Vulcan, except, you know, like, what do we mean by that? I mean, are we talking about their physical form, just because they look like Vulcans, just to save on makeup, probably? Or it's a shorthand for the audience. Well, you know what Vulcans are like now, and we're just going to say these people are reasonable like that. In fact, they use the term reasonable as if to say logical. Right? They're like, we're going to make these people very much like Vulcans. I don't know. I know what they're trying to present a race that's very reasonable so that we can have an intelligent discussion with them and it not just be all about fear-mongering and primitive, there's something unknown, so it must be the enemy, you know? I mean, these are reasonable people. So you can have, you know, this kind of accidental interaction, and you can get over it more quickly. And it's sort of an out for the writers, I think. Makes it easier to write the show, because you're really just talking about the intellectual issues of one group of people talking to another group of people who previously didn't know that there was such a thing, you know. But I understand the shorthand, but it doesn't actually fit in the history of Star Trek.
No, I can agree with that. And, you know, when we say, I mean, I do agree, by the way, that the aliens are made this way so that the writers have the, you know, have an out. I don't necessarily describe that as a bad thing. I think sometimes, you know, in order to get your story across in a clean way, I think it's acceptable for them to, you know, to frame it in such a way. I think that, you know, obviously, people watch Star Trek and they like the stories that are told, and it can't be as, you know, it can't be as nitty gritty as everyday real life. And the fact that they make them Vulcans just allows them, in my opinion, to focus on different aspects of the story than they would have had to have done had it been a, you know, perhaps a more realistic, you know, warlike civilization that would come and try to, you know, scalp Picard as soon as he beamed down.
Yeah, right. Scalp Picard.
anyway, Luke. Do we have a captain's log?
We do, actually. How would you know that? I haven't done one for a while. How would you know that I would have one? Oh, you've tapped into my computer somehow. Captain's log. We are en route to Mintaka 3, where a three-man, or should I say two-man and one-woman Federation anthropological field team is but just one failing hollow generator away from violating the Prime Directive. The team is studying the inhabitants from a duck blind that is about to get its sight back. Our mission is to resupply the team of whiskey and pass the time. repair their malfunctioning rock maker. I expect the mission will be fraught with glitches and problems that will turn the poor Mintakans' lives into turmoil. Hey, nothing like a little honesty in the log once in a while, huh?
And they don't seem to be in a huge hurry, right, to get there.
No.
because
not initially.
They have. It's always something that's been. It confuses me with Star Trek. What the standard, you know, cruising speed is, because there's always the opportunity to go a little bit faster. It seems so. These, I don't know what speed they were going initially, but then they were told that they could increase speed to warp 7 and get there in something like 21 minutes, something like that. And then you even think, but warp 7, that doesn't really sound that fast. I mean, are they trying to save on the fuel or something? And then when the, you know, when the explosion happens, it's warp 9. But even warp 9, it's not that fast. So why not warp 9.5 or 9.9 or... It's something that always bugs me. There doesn't seem to be a consistency in cruising speed.
I always thought there were things like speed limits in certain parts of space. I mean, you should have speed limits. If everybody's flying around at warp 9, there's got to be an accident sometime.
Space is very... You're not going to run into other people very much. And you do have subspace sensors to detect if you're going to, right? So you can move around. Mm-hmm. But this whole... All right, so I'm having trouble starting this, but I don't really like the fact that we put numbers onto warp, right? It seems to me like the numbers should have been a little more hidden, and maybe ships should have said we're using standard speed or full speed or flank speed, you know, use those kind of terms. So you can standardize the terms and makes it much easier for the writer, right? We're using standard speed or we're using full speed because we want to go a little bit faster, but not in an emergency. Use flank when it's an emergency. And then, you know, allow the techs later on and the nitpicking audience members like us to figure out how much that was. What is that related to the speed of light? You know, I think it would have been easier and better if it had done that way. And that's the way naval ships are done now. You know, when you go aboard different Navy vessels, they all use, you know, one third, two third, standard, full, and flank. Every ship has that, pretty much. And yet, but the actual speeds that you're achieving are different depending on what kind of model ship you are. You know, they change over time. I do think, though, that generally, most of the time, just due to the laws of thermodynamics, the faster you go, the less efficient your engine is. And so it does make sense to go as slow as possible that still achieves the mission, generally.
Mm. Well, I think they probably use warp speeds in numbers because obviously 2 is better than 1 and 5 is even much, much better than 2 and 8 is just way terrific. And, oh my goodness, 9, that's just incredible. But here's another thing that I was thinking, and sometimes I think like this. Here's the deal. When you're at warp, you're using your deflector dish to do what? Deflect things, right? So you got little rocks in space, little asteroids or tiny asteroids or whatever in space, and your deflector is deflecting them. The faster the ship is going, the greater the deflection, I would assume. So if you're going warp 2, it's just a minor, just move that aside. Whereas if you're going warp 9, that deflection probably is going to take that object and just really give it some massive thrust. So the more times that you thrust things around, the greater chance you have of those things landing on planets that they never would have landed on because they were in a different trajectory and you just took their trajectory. Unless the warp field just makes it go around the ship and back in its normal trajectory that it would have been, because I think when you're pushing things in space, they've got to go somewhere.
So they do have to go somewhere, but that makes it sound like a, you know, the equivalent of a wake on a ship. So the faster you go, the more disruption you cause behind you, which is an interesting idea. One issue that I have with warp speeds, in particular with Next Gen, when they decided to give, you know, the warp 10 barrier, and I'm not actually, I don't recall where that is mentioned first, that warp 10 is the barrier. But what you end up with, and I think it gets a little silly, is that you end up with, you know, warp 9, wow, that's fast. And then warp 9.5 is much, much, much faster. It's like 10 times faster. And then you end up with this, you know, you end up with, as you're approaching the infinite barrier, you end up with 9.9, 9.99, 9.9999. And I don't think the viewer particularly thinks that 9.975 is that much faster than warp 9.8. Mm-mm. But it's from the physics of the show, it's supposed to be. And I think that's something that the this idea of the warp barrier kind of, it doesn't, you know, effectively, if you're dealing with speeds that are, you know, warp 9.8 versus warp 9.975, effectively you have to rescale it and then turn them into proper numbers again. Because no one's going to be sitting there going, oh, I think 9.992 today. It just doesn't, you know, it's not natural for humans to be dealing in such fine, you know, splitting of the decimals.
And I think that was my point. You know, instead of having to rescale it all the time, just keep the generic terms that you rescale off screen, you know? It's just that's the way it you do that kind of stuff. You keep the terms generic.
Yeah, but I actually completely agree. I think when you mentioned it, it made a lot of sense. And I think it's absolutely, completely reasonable. And I don't know why they didn't do it. It sounds like an obvious thing.
Okay. So they're watching these Mentakans from a mountain range, and I'm curious how that's helpful to them, because once they go into their huts, I'm sure they're out of sight. There's no audio, so the only thing they're watching is little Mentakans walking around.
I think that the whole idea of the duck blind is a little stupid. In particular, you mentioned the fact that, you know, what you're going to do, look out the window and watch these people wander around the, you know, the rocks. It's not a great position to be for observation. And I don't exactly know why they need a big window just large enough to fall out of. To me, I think you could have been, you know, 3/4 mile away with a proper sensor setup or a proper monitoring post. But, you know, I'm happy to take the conceit of the setup.
I'm sure with the technology they had, they could just have a lot of micro cameras floating around all over the place. You know, that the Mentakans would only perceive as gnats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or go the Hunger Games route, where you just plant the cameras in all the trees all over the place, or in the rocks, so you can just watch what's going on. Yeah, the whole concept of the duck blind is just a bit archaic, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, and yet they bring it back in Star Trek Insurrection.
Yeah, but they also have people walking around in their own personal little cloaking devices. Yeah. That was, you know, I'm surprised that they didn't do that before the movies. I mean, yeah, it'd have been nice walking around the Mentakans, follow them right inside their hut. So, yeah. How many ended up in OG's bedroom, though? So.
Okay.
Do you really have such a hard time separating your sexuality from your professional life? Come on, man.
So, Data, you're talking to a man that sits in front of cameras all day, of course.
So, anyway. Okay, poor Palmer. He throws himself out the window and falls down the side of the mountain. So here's how it looks to me that each person gets hurt. Dr. Baron is knocked out after a console blows up in his face. The lady scientist, Dr. Warren, is shocked in the arm. I mean, that's all it seems to me is she gets shocked in the arm. Palmer, he falls down the side of the mountain. So which one will die? And the answer sure surprised me. She got a little shocked in the arm. But you know, one of them had to die. Yeah, it could have.
Yeah, it was coincidence that they died at just the right moment, you know. You held out just long enough, but yeah.
It was right, and Dr. Crusher takes care of the one who had that console explode in his face.
And also, when you watch it, it really seems like Palmer purposely jumped out the window. You know?
Yes, it does.
And it's like, was he just trying to get away from the electricity? Or, devious thought here, maybe he's watching the Mentakans and he's like a conscientious objector to the Prime Directive. He's like, no, we should not be hiding ourselves. I'm going to purposely go and expose myself to these people.
Mm-hmm.
This is my excuse. I can get away with it now.
Sounds good to me. Okay. So anyway, two Mentakans, a father-daughter team, is taking the morning readings. OG has been appointed the official record keeper for the village, and she takes her responsibilities very seriously.
Yes, until she sees a shiny thing up on the mountain and she runs up to see it.
Yep. Forget the readings. Oji, what happened to the readings today? I saw the thing up there, and Father and I had to go see it. But anyway, she looks kind of like a, you know, your typical teenager, except for she doesn't sleep in late. She didn't stay up all night playing World of Warcraft in her hut. No, she takes her job seriously.
She was very early for the readings, because they mention the readings now, and the father says you're very early, and then the readings come up like 20 minutes later in the episode is when she actually needs to go and take them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this episode is pretty condensed. I mean, pretty much the whole episode, except for the last scene, takes place within a couple hours, right? But yeah.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, she's there to take readings, and, you know, 20 minutes takes place just like right there. And then the sun goes down and there's a storm. I mean, we don't go very far into the storm. Maybe a couple hours, you know?
Okay.
I mean, yes. I think it all takes place in less than a day, certainly, but it could be as little as, you know, 6 or 7 hours. I mean, not that long.
I was about to say, I don't think, you know, for example, when they capture Troy at relatively close at the beginning of the episode, I don't think she sleeps. So I think that's certainly a day, less than a day that Troy is captured.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so Dr. Crusher hyposprays Dr. Baron awake, and what's he say? It sounds like he's saying, "Keep work, Palmer." Sounds. Do you guys get that? Or it doesn't matter. But as they're working in the lab, one the father men talking, Liko, right?
Yeah.
He goes up the side of the mountain and looks inside as two people disappear, and that's when Data turns around and notices him. And, of course, Liko touches the side of the still-charged wall and zap and falls down the mountain. And, of course, Dr. Crusher has to run after him and decides to beam him up to the ship, which OG sees. So let's talk about this morality effect. Picard walks into sickbay to admonish Dr. Crusher for bringing that back.
Can I mention a few things before we get into that stuff?
Yeah, go ahead.
Just a few minor things. I mean, like, when they beam down, Geordi mentioned something about how everything's charged, don't touch anything. It's just this common sci-fi special effect of lightning jumping around equipment. Like, you'd have to have some pretty high voltages to have that kind of visual effect. It's like, I don't care how close, the lightning would be jumping to the away team. I don't know. It's just it's a common problem.
It's still going to arc.
Yeah, it's going to arc. I mean, with how close they got to it. Plus, they obviously are pretty unobservant. Like, they're all hoarding tricorders, and then their tricorders didn't notice that Liko was nearby. And when Beverly runs down to check on Liko, like, she got out through some kind of door, apparently. Nobody went with her, right? There's no teamwork in this away team. And she's got her tricorder out to check on Liko. I guess she doesn't check to see that OG is, like, 10 feet away, and she just didn't notice. Just some minor little quibbles.
Right.
But it was an emergency, and Beverly is focused on saving a person's life, so it's totally understandable.
Yeah, because we're the ones that did this to him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about the morality debate. You should have let him die.
Jeez. It seems pretty wrong, right? Even if maybe Picard initially thinks that, oh, we beam down and Dr. Crusher, through the duck blind, maybe saw somebody get injured and then she jumped out and tried to help him, right? So maybe initially Picard thinks, this guy just got injured. We didn't cause the injury. Why are you jumping out and exposing yourself and the Prime Directive violation just to save his life, right? And from that perspective, you could almost understand the point that, yeah, you should not have saved his life because we're maintaining the secrecy is more important. But, you know, that's assuming that Picard didn't realize the situation, exactly what happened. But immediately Beverly tells him, no, we caused his injuries. And I think he should immediately go, okay, absolutely save his life. Do whatever you can. But he still questions it. He's like, still not sure I'm following your reasoning. Really?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's like one of the most horrible interpretations of the Prime Directive that we get in this episode. That you're saying that our random law that we came up with is more important than these people's lives? I mean, it's one thing that it's more important than my life, more important than the life of a Starfleet member who took an oath. But these people didn't take an oath to the Prime Directive. Anyway.
Okay. Doc?
I tend to agree with this. I don't think Picard's kind of like his position is particularly valid. The only thing when I was watching it, I was certainly when the first line, I was trying to figure out whether or not he was just trying to play devil's advocate here, whether he actually knew that they had to do something, but he was effectively throwing he was throwing down to Beverly what would probably be thrown back to him by the Admiralty. Or whenever he had to report in to Starfleet Command. So I kind of took this as a little bit of a, because later Picard's happy, right? Or not happy, but he is prepared to go and fix the situation on the planet and to make things better. And that doesn't mean that anyone that happens to see you, you have to kill for the purpose of, purifying their culture. It means handle it in a way that does the least damage. And I think that Beverly's position is very similar. He sees them, he is then injured by their presence, and then she's trying her best to make sure that they do not get injured by their presence. And I think by the letter of the law, right, it is the interference that caused this guy to fall off the cliff and die, and that's as much as interference as saving his life would be considered interference. So I thought Picard was a little bit out of kilter with what later transpires in the episode in any case.
So then, as you say, in for a penny, in for a pound. You've already gone this far. You might as well just go ahead and do this one more thing.
Well, no, I think it's more along the lines of just, there's obviously you don't want to interfere with other people's cultures, but that it's not made better, right, that if you happen to be seen by someone by accident, you don't exterminate the planet and say, well, at least they didn't see us. I think that the way that they... Mm-hmm. I actually quite like the way that Picard behaves in this episode, whereby he attempts to make the interaction as low-key and as non-consequential as possible. I mean, he's advised by a crazy science dude to go down and pretend to be God and lay out some foundations, and I think what he does instead is a lot more Starfleet, in a way, a lot more with what I believe Picard's moral compass is. So I don't like this idea that Prime Directive is you can do anything as long as you don't interfere, and the interference is very narrowly defined. I think that it's much more to do with, what is the impact of you being there? And I think that's what they try to smooth.
I think, and it's always been my opinion, that the Prime Directive is sort of misnamed, and it makes people focus on the wrong thing. Labeling it the non-interference directive implies you're focusing on interference. Well, any kind of contact with anybody else is interference. Right? They would have done something, but as soon as you're there, they react differently. You're interfering with them. And so, where do you draw the line? It becomes a very tricky question over where is the line drawn, and that's what we're getting into, these kind of discussions about, is saving the life interference, or is letting them know that they live on a planet and there's other aliens, is that interference, right? I think we're focusing on the wrong thing, and it's always been, especially in TNG and later Treks. I think the original series did it better. But I think there's too much focus on that. And what it would help if the Prime Directive was called what it really should have been, which is the non-coercion directive. Mm. Right? It's okay to interact when appropriate, as long as you don't coerce people to do something. Right? As long as... So then it becomes a lot more clear. Should we save their life? well, yeah, they're probably going to want us to save their life. It's okay for us to do that, or we can ask permission to save their life. But anyway, so I think it really there should be a focus on, are you coercing these people to do something against their will? That's what's wrong about more advanced cultures coming in and taking over less advanced areas, right?
Right. I think that's true. And also, I mean, the spin that I always place on it in my mind is, you know, it's kind of related to, you know, my country's, you know, past, which is, you know, we went abroad, we found places that weren't as civilized as us, and we civilized them. And that's really what I think that's what they're trying to prevent. You know, they don't want Starfleet to go to a far-off planet full of, you know, natives and say, hey, you know, here's our culture, you know, here's our culture and beliefs, now, you know, get to it. So I've always considered it as a kind of like an antidote to the imperialism that would have been part of, like, you know, the European empires going back, you know, 500-600 years or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the Prime Directive is aptly named the Prime Directive. It's just a subname. It didn't they say in another series or episode that it's General Order Number 1? And I think there's a lot of directives that they have to follow, but this is the number one directive. The Prime Directive is the non-interference directive. So I think the fact they call it Prime is really nothing serious. It's just another way of saying this is our number one rule.
Yeah. There was an episode of Voyager where we learned even the Prime Directive itself had 47 sub-directives. So, I mean, there's an acknowledgement in some of Trek that this is a complicated issue. And I feel like in some cases, and even a little bit in this episode, you know, the discussion about, well, should we let him die or not? I'm like, you're focusing on the wrong thing. Ultimately, I think this episode does a pretty good job. I think Picard takes a pretty good stance of, I don't want to coerce these people. I don't want to give them a lie, right? I don't want to perpetuate a lie and say that I actually am God, right? But I need to get over the fact that we've had some minor interactions and you know, smooth it over. I think it's a pretty good answer in this episode. But there are other episodes where they just focus too much on, well, non-interference, the best way to not interfere is to just wash our hands of it and not make an actual intelligent reasoned decision. Yeah.
Which I really don't see Star Trek ever doing. I don't really ever see the Prime Directive really being followed to the letter. They always go outside. And really, if you think about it, had OG not seen her own father and this alien disappear, really, if she had just beamed him aboard, healed his wounds and beamed him back, but unfortunately, while he was there, he woke up and saw other beings and what was going on around him. Had she done that, it could have been explained away as a dream.
Yeah.
So, okay, so anyway. So we covered all of that.
Two minor little things in the sickbay scene. I don't know if you guys caught in the background, there was a mention of trichordrazine being used. It's one that Beverly was... It's just a cool callback to the Cordrazine from the original series, which appeared in a couple episodes of the original series. Most notably, The City on the Edge of Forever, when Dr. McCoy accidentally shot himself with some.
Mm. So what's try?
It's futuristic. You add on try and die, right? That's the Star Trek future version of things. I don't know.
I thought there were like three different forms of Cordrazine. Cordrazine light, and... Cordrazine with lemon. I don't know.
There's also that brief moment when Picard is talking to Worf about, you know, take us into a close orbit, and Worf is arguing, oh, well, that's only going to increase our scanning ability by 4%. It's just yet another one of those moments where Worf makes us, you know, gets immediately shot down.
Well, yeah. Of course, he's always getting shot down, but... Okay, well, we better go on. Riker and Troy beam down surgically altered...
We can't go that fast yet.
Why?
Okay, so, Dr. Pulaski's memory wiping.
Yeah, that wasn't going to work.
Okay, first of all, I'm not convinced that Dr. Pulaski's method works at all, and that's why now Beverly gets shown up for for not being able to wipe the memory. I think Pulaski was bluffing last season. And then, however, having said that, of course, Picard says to Beverly, said, hey, you better wipe his memory. But Beverly can't even keep him sedated. How likely is it that she's going to be able to wipe his memory? Doesn't seem reasonable to me.
Ah, so you're saying maybe Sarjenka was screwed for here from now on because of all that she witnessed and saw.
Why do you keep coming back to this, that people are screwed just because they know the truth? Right? I mean, this is like a big point for me in this episode, right? Picard in a later episode will say that the Starfleet officer's first duty is to the truth. And in this episode, when Uncle Moudry tells him, you know who I'm talking about when I say Uncle Moudry?
I don't know.
Dr. Barron in this episode, tells him, hey, just go be a god. James Green is the actor. Also played a character called Uncle Moudry over on Alien Nation, different television show. So whenever I see him, I just think of Uncle Moudry, although his character is very different. Anyway, I'm sorry. Barron tells him to go be a god. He tells him to lie. Go lie, but in a benevolent way, right? Give him a good, whatever the quote-unquote good morality is. And Picard takes the right stance. He's like, no, that's a lie. I'm not going to perpetuate a lie to these people. I mean, regardless of what you actually believe about, faith and God and whether or not God exists or what religions are correct or not, well, we know whatever I say is not correct. And that is, so I'm just getting back to this truth. The truth of the reality is important. And yet, how could it ever be that bad if people are exposed to the truth? And the truth is, oh, you're not the only sentient life in the universe. I mean, yeah, it's going to change your life. But ultimately, who wants to live in ignorance forever, right? I mean, come on. That's not the end of your life. That's the beginning of the new life. I don't know. That's the way I take it.
So do you feel the same if you are able to go back in time and prevent Kennedy from being killed? Would you do it? I mean, to me, I would say no, I wouldn't do it, because the unknown twist of that fate could completely, well, I don't want to say screw us, but mess us up. If Kennedy was still president for longer than he really was, I would say that our history is better than what may have come as a result. I don't know. I just think that because they introduced the Mentakans to the idea of space flight way, way, way sooner than they should have ever dreamed of this stuff.
But
they didn't leave technology or, blueprints of how to make, how to make better weapons that they can take over the local villages or endless supply of food or anything like that that would have perverted them. They gave them a bit of information that probably changed their outlook slightly, but you don't get the impression that this is world-shattering for them, which is why I think Picard's decision to present the truth is the appropriate one. Now, I think it is a more interesting question. Let's say that these guys were of faith, and they did have a huge faith in a particular structure, and then Picard came in and broke that faith. Should he repair it before he goes? Even if, we don't buy into that faith. That's an interesting question. But in this particular case, Picard tries to leave them pretty much where he left, where he found them. So I don't see the big shock to the system.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I get it. They're intelligent enough that they're not going to take what they saw and just go absolutely crazy about it. So, hey, Data, I doubt James has, but I don't know if he has or not, but have you ever seen the movie Frequency?
I don't remember it by name.
Dennis Quaid plays a firefighter, and his son plays a cop in New York, and basically the cop grew up without his father because he died in a fire, and he finds his ham radio, and because of the Aurora Borealis, he can talk back 30 years to his father, and he says, you know, if you'd only taken the left turn instead of going with your instincts, you know, you would have survived. Don't do it. And sure enough, he follows that advice, and he survives. Now, all of history has changed because of that, and in this case of the movie, several more murders take place because, you know, the firefighter's wife was a nurse and was taking care of the suspect, and he died that day. But because it's a really interesting, you know, what can happen if you change one thing.
Yeah. I don't know, though. I think you can create any scenario where it could be worse another way or it could be better another way. I mean, it's good to, you know, realize that those issues exist. But ultimately, with any kind of decision, whether it be time travel, and I don't think I want to get into that. I mean, it's bad enough when you're talking about decisions on do you expose yourself to another culture, like this Prime Directive decision, or a decision on I only have so many resources, who am I going to help? Or, you know, any number of decisions that you make every day. Ultimately, it comes down to you make the best decision you can with the information you have. And if it turns out to be wrong, then you were wrong. You know, that's part of life. That's part of being human or whatever race you are. And just because the decision is difficult does not mean it shouldn't be made. And it shouldn't be made as best you can. And that's really, like, another reason I hate some Prime Directive episodes is because they tend to use the Prime Directive as an excuse to not make the decision. They just will wash their hands of the whole situation instead of actually getting in and making the difficult decision. But
all right. Well, guys, we better go on. But hey, I love debates like this. This is awesome. I'm curious, guys, you know, people listening to this, where do you fall on this whole Prime Directive thing? And let us know what you think as well. So as I was mentioning, unless you got more, Riker and Troy beam down surgically altered as Mintakans. And boy, I tell you, they do surgeries well in the future. There's no scarring, no bruising. But they want to find Palmer and just see how messed up this situation has become. What do you guys think of the sub-Q communicators implanted so they can hear transmissions, but no one around them can?
I think it's a great bit of technology that's just rarely used in Trek. They did use it once they used something similar in a TOS episode. It wasn't actually a constant transmitter, but it was implanted so they could call for help if needed. And it just seems like the kind of thing that realistically, like, shouldn't that just be normal? Shouldn't they all have
transmitters? Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
I thought about that.
It's just unfortunate.
I thought about that, and I have here, I say, I would make them mandatory issue for all Federation officers. However, there are certain circumstances where you don't need Big Brother listening in.
Just because you have it implanted doesn't mean you have to have it turned on all the time, right?
But how do you turn it on?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, you know, it's funny you should mention this because I don't know if you... The novelization of Star Trek The Motion Picture was written by Gene Roddenberry, right? And in the novelization, there's a part that happens before what we see in the movie. Admiral Kirk gets a call from Starfleet that there's an emergency and he has to go into his office. He gets that call by a subcutaneous transmitter that's implanted in all flag officers. Mm. It's just this little thing in the novel, you know, but it does come up sometimes. Every once in a while, writers realize, hey, this is an idea. I don't know. Maybe in the future iteration of Trek, it'll be more common, you know.
I don't know. I don't think Will wants Picard listening to some conversations that he has. So the Mintakan women are pimps, huh?
You are applying your social norm to their social. No, I don't know. I think we could be more open to it. Come on.
Yeah, hey, why not? I don't know. You got to negotiate his services.
I was a little confused by the word that Troy chose to use. You know, she said Montaukan women precede their mates, as if to say, you know, he's mine, and you need to check with me first. What definition of precede is she using there?
Well, she means walk in front of.
All right, that's probably the most likely definition.
Oh, yeah, because actually when they walk up to the hut that they're going to go in, they actually look at each other because they see a couple Montaukans and the woman is in front. She's leading the man in, and that the mates are, the woman is head of the family, I guess. Or maybe not, but she precedes him wherever they go. He follows her.
Yeah, that's true.
So what can Troy fetch for Riker?
Jesus. So talking about social norms, and this is one thing that I, you know, my brain always wanders onto. You know, Riker's been down. He's the only man with a beard we see throughout the entire episode. I hope they've done their research and, you know, and this isn't like the first bearded man anyone has ever seen, because the Montaukans can't grow beards. Or it's completely, absolutely against everything they believe to have a non-clean-shaven man. It was just something that I picked up on. My brain goes in odd directions.
Yeah. Well, there's...
Hey, Jonathan, we need you to shave for tonight's episode. Hell no! No. Take me out of it instead. Put Data there. That's fine. No. Mm-mm.
Maybe they could have used a chin cap and makeup or something. But
then he'd have big fat chin.
Yeah. Yeah, there's all kinds of problems with them beaming down, right? I mean, are they really speaking the language that fluently? And their lips... I mean, this is a typical... Universal translator issues that we have there. But even if you get over the language... Yeah, I mean, you're right, James. It's just there's so many cultural things that you just don't know about these people. You're taking a big risk. But, you know, there are heroes. They take these risks. Risk is their business, as Captain Kirk would say, right? So,
I think even surgically altered, if I were to be dropped into another country... I'd probably stick out like a sore thumb, even if they made me look like, you know, the other person. I think, so on 10-4, they always do the book clubs, and they talk about the Enterprise novels and how Trip gets implanted into Romulan society as a spy. There's no way in the world you could implant someone who hasn't had a vast amount of experience and needs to learn about the culture. You can't just pick people up and throw into other cultures, because there'll be things that you do that you consider as part of your society, and they simply would not. Like, you know, Troy mentions about that. You know, we're here to trade clothes or textiles or something. You don't know whether that's offensive to those guys. You don't know if they've got a system of barter yet. There's a lot of things you have to be very careful of, and it always generally just gets brushed aside as, yeah, they look like us. They must do things similar to us.
Oh, I don't know about that, because, I mean, obviously Baron was watching them from the duck blind, and they could probably see how they trade cloths, and
You'd you'd have to do the research, so you'd have to go down the big list and say, bearded men tick. Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Riker, you don't have to shave when you go down.
No, yeah, exactly.
You know, they don't even change their names when they go down. They still call them Silver and Troy. Are those common Montaukan names? Or... I mean, they sort of get away with it by saying we're travelers, you know. They can say we're foreigners, you know. And to be fair about the Enterprise novels, when Trip went undercover as a Romulan, he sucked at it. For many years, he kept getting caught just constantly. It actually became rather annoying in those novels. But anyway.
I was going to say, I've never read any of them, so I have no idea.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
I found it... So this comment about... women possibly being pimps in the Montaukan society, right? Like, Riker says, what did he say? He called it sensible.
He's sensible, like, people.
Sensible people. You know, it's just, every once in a while you get these illusions in Trek about how, where is the culture of the Federation society? Are they free to express their sexuality or not? Because they're actually on a 1980s television show that can't, you know? Like, it sort of makes you wonder, where is, I don't know, how free is their culture? And what is Star Trek trying to support here? Are they trying to say that this really is a sensible way to do things, that we should be open to having pimp women? I don't know. It's nice that they throw these little lines in every once in a while to challenge your conceptions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, let's see here. So they're inside this community center because, you know, they live in huts, but I'm curious how they were able to create concrete. Because I don't know if you notice this, but as you look along the hut wall, you see what looks like concrete walls. Well, let's just assume they can, but they haven't figured out that concrete would make a great house someday. Troy tells Leeko that he and OJ must have shared the same dream. That is not reasonable, which, hey, that's logical. What do you guys believe about that? I thought she's right. That's crap. They shared the same dream because, I don't know, if my daughter shared some of my dreams, she might end up in therapy. But
oh, wow.
So I'd have been like, excuse me, who are you again? But anyway.
Trace doing her best to act particularly weird, right?
Right, but they accept them very, very fast.
They must be a very tolerant society.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, back to them being quote-unquote proto-Vulcans, right? Obviously, Vulcans would not really be. But this society is very open. They're very, very peaceful. You know, it's very. Like you say, James, it's an okay shorthand. You know, we want to focus on certain aspects of it, so we ignore the other aspects. But yeah. Anyway.
Okay. So, Record of Picard, the culture of contamination is worse than we thought. The Mentakans are starting to believe in a god, and the one they've chosen is... Dun-dun-dun! You! You! So...
Actually, one thing I'd like to point out, and, you know, with all their, like, reasonableness, I actually quite appreciate how the... In my opinion, at least, I think as a group of Mentakans get together and have a chat... I think you can almost see it logically or reasonably escalate. So I actually thought that by the end of it, I wasn't thinking, oh, you know, how did they get to the point of now believing in a god? I actually thought that you know, the guys spoke about it and they talked and they kind of fell onto it, maybe a little too easily, but at least I could see the argument that was being made as to why they ended up in this position. You didn't need... One thing I often don't like is when there's an idea that spreads and it could only have spread because you're talking to morons. I think in this case, there was a little bit of argument being used and you could see how things were escalating based on, you know, people not having all the knowledge and a bit of, you know, a bit of revision from history and a couple of key witnesses. And I quite like that.
Okay. All right, then. Now, do you guys remember Fento? He just kind of seemed like the wise old guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He seemed to be that he might be like half Mentakan and half Native American. I mean, he seemed like him and Chakotay might have gotten along really well. Talked about the old days, but I don't know.
I think you're overlaying your social norms again.
Yeah, okay. But
I mean, he certainly had a village elder persona.
Yes.
I liked him. He was very cool. And, you know, it feels bad that Riker has to tie him up. But anyway.
What does everyone think about the Troy diversion of, hey, everyone, look over here? did that work?
Yeah, it worked pretty well, except OG had to remember her duties, right? You do wonder... How was Troy going to get out of it eventually? Was she going to be the one who had to run off and find a cave in order to beam up? You know, but she put herself out there, and she ends up getting captured for a while for it, you know? I mean...
Almost shot with an arrow.
Yeah, almost. Mm. It's decent.
I like the escape sequence. I think that they do that pretty well as Riker kind of tries to escape. And it goes on... longer than you would think it would go on if he were to get away. So I was almost convinced, I remember watching it first time, I was almost convinced that they must catch Riker because they were making such a big deal about the escape. But in the end, he does get away just by, you know, by a couple of seconds.
Yeah, and then the inverse of that is true. Like, because I have seen the episode many times, right, and I know he will get away, I get impatient. I'm like, why are you taking so long? You don't need to go that far, Riker. Just get behind a rock and beam up.
Well, you had that one guy who was seemed to run pretty quick. And every time, you know, Riker, how did Riker even know that he could see him at any point? Mm-hmm. So you're right. I mean, all Riker had to do was go to the top of the stairs, go to their little entrance area, and just beam out right there.
Right.
Far as Fento knows, he walked out the door.
Right.
And actually, did anyone notice that from a continuity perspective, it's almost certain that Riker would have to have double backed on himself as he's being chased? Because there's a scene as he's running over, into the distance, and then they cut to the guy coming and chasing him, and then they cut back to where Riker is, and Riker is closer than he was when he left the scene on the last occasion.
Mm-hmm. I didn't pick up on that minor thing, but it's...
ruined the episode.
What you do pick up on is this like compound crossbow or bow that they have, right, for a Bronze Age civilization. Mm-hmm. In that they have
pretty ingenious, actually.
but
I also noticed a continuity, sort of kind of glitch on that bow. You know, when he was pointing it at Troy, you could see what looks like a little trap door or something built on the bow. To where I don't think the bow could have actually been shot out because this little hook would have stopped it from going out. But you don't see it all the time whenever they're holding the bow. You only see it when he was pointing it at Troy. Another thing, what about the flying hawk?
Yeah, it's probably just coincidental timing for that, but I think it worked well.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't say, damn it! There was a hawk there. We got to do it again. There's no hawks on this planet. Come on. We got to do it again.
Might as well be. Yeah.
Yeah, but it fits. And that's why. And you say I'm putting my social whatever into this. No. To me, it fit because when you think Native American, you think the hawk. And the fact that Fento looked Native American to me, and now you've got this hawk here, it just made it seem kind of Indianish to me. But. Proto-Vulcan, that's what they were gunning for. But it doesn't matter. So, all right, so it's now time to discuss what the Picard will do to them for allowing Palmer to escape. He must punish Troy to show the Picard that Riker and Troy acted alone. But Noria is unwilling to harm her needlessly. But if they don't find Riker and Palmer, they just might. Okay, conference. It's now time to discuss this. And like you said, this is where Baron tries to tell Picard, you need to go down there and show them what's expected of them. As far as conferences go, I got to give this one a solid 5. Just the conference, guys. A good 5. What about you?
I mean, I'm happy to take this next. I think that the speech that Picard ends up giving, where he mentions that he's not prepared to send them back to the Dark Ages and, you know, full of ignorance and fear and superstition. I think that's really very, very good. And something that I was going to mention right at the top of the episode, but I didn't have a chance to. I think Picard's performance in this episode might be the best that I've seen him so far. I think the scenes that he has, firstly with the doctor, the scientist here, and then later with Nuria, I really bought into, and I think he's, you know, frankly, I think he's bang on the money, and I think it's really, you know, a really powerful performance that he gives. And then, of course, the final scene when he's down on, well, not the final scene, that's the scene, the climax when he's down on the planet. I think he performs what he is asked to do in this episode extremely well, mm-hmm. Patrick Stewart.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Data, what about you?
Oh, yes, I definitely enjoy the scene. Think it's very well. It's written to pull out the important points in a short amount of time. And of course, Patrick Stewart's acting is awesome. I do chuckle when, like, Baron recommends that he pretend to be a god, and I think about all the times that Kirk pretended to be a god. You know, it's like it. And
I'm sorry. Did you say Kirk was pretending? That's crap.
Actually, that's the point.
It actually didn't happen that much. The Omega Glory, I guess, is the most. But sometimes he was accidentally. People thought he was a god. I don't think he tried to do it that often. But
I mean, that's actually a point that I have got listed a little further down. I think that this episode really shows the contrast between Kirk and Picard, because I think Kirk would have gone with, "Hey, yeah, we'll go down. I'll pretend to be God. I'll sort them out, and I'll give them a moral backbone of what they need." I think that's how the Kirk character would have been written. He certainly wouldn't have been down on the planet prepared to sacrifice himself for the principle. I just wouldn't buy Kirk in that role. Maybe I'm being too harsh, and I see this as being a. I think it's a clear instance of Picard being Picard. And how he, you know, how he fulfills the role that he's expected to in this particular, in this show. I think Kirk would have been much more fast and loose with going down and interfering, and hey, if they need to learn about, you know, how awesome Kirk is in order to get along in life, then that's fine.
Okay. All right, let's see where we're at here. So, Picard's solution. What do you think of the solution of bringing Nuri aboard and showing her how the magic works? I guess we discussed it a little at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean... You know, my opinion is that... I mean, just being truthful is usually the right way to go.
Yeah.
Do you really have to be, though? I mean... Because you do worry about the long-term ramifications of, you know... Having a culture suddenly realize, or at least a small portion of that culture suddenly realize that you're not alone, there are aliens, there is this advanced technology. I don't know what I would have done in this situation. Like, maybe I would just beam up Troy and go away. And like, yeah, it'll sort itself out. But you're probably right. I mean, Picard is probably right. It's taken the easy out. Right, you really should get out there and talk to him. Just admit, we made some mistakes. We're sorry. We're going to leave you alone. Even though we may not actually leave you alone, maybe we're lying to you. Right?
Yeah, we'll find out in a year or two.
I don't know. I mean, is Starfleet still going to come down and watch these people? Just not let them know?
No, they dismantled it, didn't they?
Well, he says they're going to dismantle it. But are they? I don't know.
True. Section 31 took over the project.
But yeah, I mean, and obviously the whole process of him actually bringing Nuri up and the reasoning that he goes through and the whole, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's third law, any sufficiently advanced technology could be considered magic, you know. Mm-hmm. It's all done very well.
All right. Well, just before he beams her up, though, Picard, Data, and Riker are on the bridge, and I thought, you know, this is interesting. They're all standing around Data Station, and this time it's Picard's crotch in Data's face as, you know, they're trying to determine if Nuri is the one walking and try and get her alone and beam her up. And, you know, it's another interesting question. They said when she's alone, lock sensors on her when she's alone. Now, how do they know when she's alone? How would they know that there's another Mentakin 20 feet away from her, but there's a wall between them versus the nearest Mentakin is 150 feet away, but could still see her in a field?
Sensors.
It's the sensors that have the capability of plot, right? When all you need to do is pick out one human on the planet, you know, Palmer, you can't find him. But when you need to figure out if there's a thin layer of curtain material between one Mentakin and another Mentakin, then you can do it, right?
Yes.
It's a little inconsistent, obviously.
Right.
It makes more sense from our perspective in, you know, like visual. Like, if you actually had to send out helicopters to look for a missing man in the woods, you might not find him. But if you had a, you know, that would explain not being able to find Palmer. But if you had a camera hidden on Troy, and you can just see, oh, Neri is going over there right now. You know, it sort of makes sense from our current level. But these Magic Enterprise D sensors, you'd think things would be a little different when you think about it. But
you know, you raise a point. Why? What was the reason why the sensors couldn't find him?
Oh, they explained it away as something in the rocks or something like that, you know. but at one point he gets out of the rocks, right? I mean, he or he gets discovered. No, he got discovered in a cave, right? One of the Metallicans went into the cave. So
yeah, he wandered in
a
cave.
It was already too late by that point. Yeah. So I don't know. Hey, you ever notice how Captain Picard has a history of bringing young women from pre-warp civilizations onto his ship? In the first season, in Justice, he brought Reven on board. He does it here. He does it in the episode First Contact when he brings Marasta Yale on board. And he does a movie First Contact when he brings Lily Sloan on board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rascal.
Let me show you my ship.
Yes. Now come to my quarters. Anyway, you've never seen one of these. Never mind. So this is a change of pace. Data's Riker's crotch in Data's face. You know, it's different. The Picard maneuver, it's just not as suave as the Riker maneuver. But okay, so let's see here. Hold on a second. Oh, no, I don't want to mention that. So, Nuria, no one is going to harm you. I am Jean-Luc Picard. Oh, boy, here we go. And she drops to her knees. Oh, gosh, I hate this. Hold on. Sorry. Okay,
yeah, it's weird. It's weird that she waited for the word to drop to her knees. I mean, of all the crazy stuff that was going on at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, she just beamed into this magical place. I don't know if I would have dropped or just fainted. So, you know, Nura, look at me. Feel the warmth of my hand, the rhythm of my pulse, the length of my... So, anyway, Picard takes her to the observation lounge to see her home from orbit. As we mentioned before, I'm going to just bypass that too.
What are you bypassing, Lou? Surely.
Well, just because, you know, now these people know space flight. We've already discussed all that.
Okay.
I remember at the beginning, I said, we'll get into that a little later. And I ended up going to it right then anyway. So now I'm coming up to these things and I need to try and avoid them.
I have to say, I think it's surprising that she recognizes her planet so quickly. Because she's obviously, you know, okay, she's seen the night sky, but I don't think the people of this age would have, you know, they probably aren't necessarily aware that, you know, they're on a sphere, so they probably think the world is flat. Possibly still, there's, you know, you could easily, I could have forgiven them for, you know, not having this scene, because I don't think there's. It's not necessarily the case that Nero would have, you know, been so aware that this was, you know, the planet, and she's seen on the other side of the clouds, etc., etc.
I think this race, based on how logical and reasonable they are, I don't think it's such a stretch that they already know they're living on a sphere. I mean, they take detailed measurements of the sun at zenith, and they understand celestial concepts. And in our history, you know, the Bronze Age was, what, 700 AD? But
I actually looked.
Oh, good.
I looked that up, and I lost it. It was, let's go back to Google and do that again. It was like something 2600 to 1200 BC.
Oh, okay, yeah. Because I know, like, they figured, some people figured out the sphere thing. you know, a good hundreds of years BC, but probably not that back that far. But I mean, there's no reason to think that they couldn't have evolved differently, obviously. But I mean, we get a feeling that they understand celestial dynamics a bit. So, but then again, is Nuria a scientist? I mean, some people on her planet might understand these things, but then again, OG is raised to understand at least part of it, right? And she's just a young woman. So,
I got a feeling they all do. I mean, they seem all intelligent enough that they teach each other all of these things as children. So yeah, no, I don't see why it's a problem that she ends up on a ship and sees her planet and realizes that's what it was. So, okay, so what do you guys think of Picard trying to dig himself out of this hole by trying to explain to Nuria how his people evolved that parallels her people's evolution? And how her ancestor would react to her.
Oh, yeah. I think it's great in every way.
Yeah. I mean, you can even see the actor, the actress who plays Nuria. You can see she's tense until, you know, how do you think your ancestor would feel? Well, she would fear me, just as you fear me. And you could just see all the tension drop from her body as she says, "I no longer fear you." But still, he thinks he's getting across to her, and she now understands what he's saying. But until they get into, you know, a little bit later when she asked to bring back the six Mintakans who died in last year's flood.
Yeah, I wonder about this. You know, like we talked of earlier about how it was just coincidence that the one scientist held on long enough to die in an area, you know. And it's the whole concept of behold a god who bleeds, right? That's the way you prove that you're not a god, is that you bleed or you die, and people are, you know, more likely to say, oh, okay, you're not really a god. But I sort of wonder if the episode might have been a little bit better if they didn't use that cliche, but instead really just had this conversation be the moment where Nuria, an intelligent, reasonable person, got it. It clicked with her. But, I mean, you're still going to have Liko, who needs his god to bleed. So I think you still have that. I don't know.
But the only thing is that she says, I don't fear you any longer. She still hasn't capitulated that you are not a god. She just says, you know, I think she's still thinking he is a god, but she doesn't need to fear this god. That's why she goes into about these six Mintakans who died in a flood last winter, and she puts a bullet point on it of four of them were children. You know, come on, show us a little sympathy and bring them back.
I must say, I agree with Data on this. I don't think that Nuria needed the kind of double whammy. I think she could have been convinced by the conversation in the observation room and not have to come back to the but why aren't you bringing, you know, these children back from the dead? I would have preferred that personally. I don't think they, you know, I don't particularly think they need the scene where you know, this woman realizes that, you know, that Picard can't save everyone, because she was rationalizing that Picard wasn't going to save the children because the children offended him. She could just as easily have rationalized that the woman in sickbay died because she also offended Picard. So I would have preferred her to have fully got the message in the one scene.
Well, obviously she saw that not only did the woman die, but everyone around her were, you know, distraught. There was absolutely nothing that we could do to save her, but we'd certainly tried. And I think that's what finally got her to realize he's not a god, or else he could have done something.
Did you notice that about, you know, 30 seconds or so before the woman died, Beverly, you know, announced over the comlink, "Hey, Picard, you better get down here. Such and such isn't going to hold on for much longer." I mean, what a great bedside manner that is.
Oh, yeah. Well, she may have been in her office for all we know, but she said she thinks they're going to lose Warren.
Oh, no, she was standing right next to the woman who was still conscious at the time.
When she said it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were seeing that from inside sickbay. We saw that happen. Picard comes in later.
Are you sure? I thought it was in his ready room.
No,
that she interrupts him.
So Picard's in the ready room, but Beverly's in sickbay. literally standing next to the woman as she's struggling for breath, announcing that she's not going to last much longer.
I see.
Mm. Yeah, okay.
I don't have much of a problem with that, though. I think it's all right.
And they are supposed to be more, you know, evolved and, and, you know, be prepared to accept death as and when it comes.
Oh, right.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, I just played it back. You're absolutely right. She's staring right at him or right at her. She says, I think we're going to lose Warren. So, yeah, that was mean. You're going to lose me, you bitch. Anyway.
Actually, I don't think Beverly does very well in this episode, right? She loses a couple of patients she probably shouldn't, and she forgets to wipe people's memory.
Well, yeah, but like you said, we don't know if Sarge Jenkins' memory is even wiped to begin with.
Yeah.
He puts her in her bed and disappears. But so, yeah, who knows? Okay, so Lico decides it's time to punish Troy and takes a bow from one of the police officers in the hut. That's what I called them. I figured they were the two cops of the village. Because they're the only ones carrying bows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I quite like it how you cut down to the planet and, you know, these guys are getting more and more worried, and the best they can come up with is kill the witch as a way of making sure that God doesn't, upset them. And then there is a bit where, it's Lico, right, uses the logic of, okay, God, I'm going to kill this woman now unless you come down this instance and tell me otherwise, because that's a perfectly valid logical argument. And then Picard walks in, so making it more fool me.
See, I told you. No, Lico, I just don't want her getting shot. Okay, so there is an oops when Warren dies. I don't know if you guys noticed it, but when Nuria and Picard are talking, the camera gets closer to them. But they actually leave Warren's hands visible. And you can see that she's trying to hold her breath, but she's not doing very well because her hand goes up and down and shakes. Picard, she's not dead. Her hand moves. You lied to me. Anyway.
A little bit earlier when they were in the ready room and looking at the Stargazer model, the NCC number on the Stargazer model was wrong.
That's what I thought, but I didn't have the courage to bring that up because it was like 7-1000 or something. This episode, it didn't click with the number that I thought it had. I've forgotten that knowledge, but it felt wrong to me, and I'm glad that I'm glad I'm not the only one that noticed.
Yeah, it was NCC 7100.
Yeah, which I mean. They probably, much like the original series, they used that number because it was easy to get out of the model kit when you had 1701. You could just out the 1 and 7 and put them in a different order. But I don't know. It was established in the first season when the Stargazer showed up. Like on screens, information screens on the Stargazer, I think it was established that they had a different number.
Yeah. It's 2893.
Yeah.
So, okay, anyway, so, Who Watches the Watchers is quite the interesting name, as I mentioned at the beginning. It could be Who Watches the Watchers Watching the Mandalorians, or another name could be Who Oversees the Overseers. Obviously, the name of the episode is a play on the words of who's watching these people, who is in charge of these people who are watching the Mandalorians. Am I right? Do I make sense?
I think it can be read many ways, to be honest.
Yeah. I think it just relates to any society that has laws or rules. You know, how do you govern yourself? How do you, you know, keep yourself in check? And certainly it applies to the Federation with the Prime Directive. And not just, you know, Federation people that watch people. I forget the word right now. Anthropologists.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it could apply specifically to the anthropologists, or it could apply to Starfleet or Federation as a whole. But, you know, just all that. Hey, So, two things briefly when Picard gets shot by the arrow. I wonder where Leeko was aiming, right? Was he trying to shoot him in the head or the heart? Because Vulcan hearts are not located where human hearts are, right? The Vulcan heart is way down in your stomach area.
Yeah, but they're not Vulcan.
All right, so who knows where the Mentalkin heart is, even though they appear to be very Vulcan. And the other thing... I'm sorry, go on.
We might have found out had OG not, hit him from behind and took off his aim.
Right. But the other thing is, I wonder if Picard, when he's up there, and he's like, I might be about to be shot in the heart or the head, remembers the fact that he has a robotic heart, and maybe it'll be more durable. It could probably take an arrow shot to the heart.
Oh, yeah. But at this point, he doesn't really know that.
Well, he knows. That was second season. When they established the fact that he had a robotic heart. Yeah,
him and Wesley and their shuttlecraft trip. Okay. Yeah, why would anyone use a defective replacement? Ah, Jesus, just pilot the shuttle, Anton. So anyway... Let's see here. So the very last thing you see is a thank you gift to Picard. Pocky, I believe his name is, hands him this little cloth thing. And I actually read on Memory Alpha, as much as I hate to bring that up, that you'll actually see it in future episodes and movies. So I've never once noticed it, so now I will. That's the only reason I bring it up, is I'm going to look for that now. But I thought the last scene was, very sweet. I thought it was very nice, Remember my people, he says, always. Obviously, they had an impact on him as much as he has an impact on them. So, very nice scene. Okay, guys, you're silent. Anybody have anything else to talk about?
I did really like the use of the outdoors, going on location, shooting. And no, we haven't really mentioned the connection with this particular place where they film.
Is this the first time they go outdoors for Next Gen?
Well, they were outdoors the very last episode in The Survivors. There was a little bit of outdoors.
Yep, that's true. You forgot that already? It was just last week, Doc.
I've forgotten that already. But I seem to, this must be the largest outdoors in terms of scale that we've seen so far.
Yeah.
When they went outdoors in Justice, right? That's first season.
Well, they go out to a park somewhere in California.
Water reclamation facility, yeah. Right. And they did a little bit of outdoors in Pen Pals, which is another, just the scenes with the horse, right?
Right. So it's ironic, right, that the scenes when you're on another planet or on a studio somewhere, the scenes where you're actually locked into the equivalent of a your PlayStation is actually filmed out in the woods somewhere.
Well, yeah. Don't forget, Encounter at Farpoint had Riker on a horse, or had Picard on a horse. So that was outdoors.
What?
Sorry, the not
Encounter at Farpoint.
Oh, shit. Hold on. Stop. No, I'm sorry. No, I'm thinking of another episode. No, it was Data and Wesley.
Oh, out in the woods.
That was outdoor, out in the woods. God, you know what I was thinking of is, where Data meets up with Sarjanka because he was on the horse when Data had to come in and tell Picard what he's done. Yeah. Excellent, Steve. That's what I was confused. Okay, so then you have... I'm leaving that all in. That's fine. That is funny stuff.
We were just talking about Pen Pals, and you somehow got confused with this other episode. Okay.
Right. Yeah, Encounter at Farpoint. They went out in the woods in Encounter at Farpoint, but it wasn't Picard on the horse. Nor was it Riker on a horse.
Not convinced that the holodeck scene in Encounter at Farpoint was on location, was it? It still looked like a sound studio.
Oh, couldn't have been.
Really?
It was too involved, unless it was a picture or a painting or something.
It might have been. There's no reason to think it wasn't a soundstage. It was built for an entire different production, and they just did their one day of filming there.
That could be. Yeah. Who knows?
It's not you don't get enough sky to say absolutely it was outdoors. But
yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Okay. Well then, guys, anything else?
I mean, we kind of had the big argument at the beginning about whether or not this encounter causes any damage, any permanent damage to society. And
we beat that one already.
Yeah, and I think everyone jets off happily ever after. I'm afraid I really do.
Okay, that's certainly fine. Okay, all right. Well, then, if not, let's see. This was episode 4. So I would have front intro, so you get to do the final thoughts there, Doc.
Okay, because I have a script. So it's right. Now time to give our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. And I think I've mentioned ones that we really must think highly of our listeners if we have to repeat that 1 is the worst and 5 is the best.
We could switch it today and make it 1 is the best and 5 is the worst, but... it'd be hard because I like my rating.
Now, actually, Lou, let me hand over to you first because I'm really worried about where I think I'm coming out on this episode. So what's your opinion?
All right. I like it a lot. And I know it sounded like I was harping on we just screwed up these people forever. But, you know, as far as the story goes and the Star Trek story, I think it's an excellent story. It seems simple. But the Matakans are very interesting people, and I really like them. I wish I could have been down to that planet and met these people and spent some time with them and learned all about their culture. But anyway, the Federation does dig itself in kind of a hole, and Picard does try to dig himself out, only having walls cave in. They might be able to get out of the hole, but they can never really fill it. So no matter what kind of shovel... size they have, in my opinion. You guys don't seem to agree, and that's cool. But I think there's going to be some after effects, and I would have loved to have seen what happened to these people 5 years down the road. Oh, so how about Star Trek Mintakans as a spin-off series? Anyway, the Mintakans now know that there are aliens in the universe. We're not sure what that effect might have on them. Did they ever know it? And like I said, the problem is only a group of Mintakans know this. The rest of the world may or may not believe them. So the conspiracies might fly like crazy. So anyway, even if Picard isn't a god, that must only mean they met someone who isn't a god, but not that gods either do or don't exist. So I believe they may establish space flight a little sooner than they would have. And... who knows how that's going to come out. But I keep harping on that. I got to stop. The story is very cute. The actors selected were very interesting. OG was very darling. And Wrecker and Troy look very good. We didn't discuss this, but I think they look very good as Mintakans. In the end, the story leaves a lot of questions open that never get closed. So it kind of gives me a 1.5-point reduction on it. So I'm going to give this one a 4.5. It's a very sweet little break from the norm. And I like the idea of meeting these new and interesting people. So let Doc think some more. Data, what about you? Yeah, combined your names, Data.
So at one point, it seems like this episode is about religion, you know, and because there's that whole speech where Picard comes down pretty hard on it, or seems to come down pretty hard on religion.
Right. Can I interrupt you? I'm sorry. I want to mention something real quick. Yeah. That discussion in the conference, I forgot to put that in my notes, but that discussion in the conference room actually became the basis of a Lou Trek Show episode at one time of religion in Star Trek, and how I said that really, I think Gene Roddenberry, who was a known atheist, had intended to keep religion out of Star Trek. And, you know, people brought up that, well, when Captain Kirk did a wedding for these two people, that one of them actually died in the episode, there was a cross in the background. And I'm like, yes, that's true. However, this whole, you know, we're not leading them down this path of superstition, paranoia, and fear. No. And I use that as an example of my idea of, other than DS9, the entire series, that Star Trek, religion seemed to be a no-no. But anyway, unless you guys want to discuss that, you can continue.
Well, I do think in general, throughout Star Trek, religion is generally frowned upon and a no-no, and that's because of Gene Roddenberry's stance on it. But and this episode seems to say that, but at the same time, it just so happens that these people aren't superstitious, and that's just part of who they are. And ultimately, I don't think the episode really says that much about religion one way or the other, because what Picard is railing against in his little moment of brilliant speech in the conference room is he's railing against the lie that, and I talked about this earlier, there may be other religions that are accurate, but this episode doesn't really talk about that. It talks about, well, this is definitely a lie and I'm not going there. And so it really doesn't actually delve that the question of religion, except in this specific case where you know the religion is false. But ultimately, I mean, I do think the episode does a pretty good job of exploring some of the facets of the Prime Directive, making decisions between do you expose yourself to other cultures, and when it happens accidentally, how do you get over it? And I think it does a very good job of finding a good balance to that and getting out of that in a good way. I think sometimes in other episodes it's too much of the hardline stance that you must die rather than violate the Prime Directive. Like, if you find yourself stranded on a pre-warp civilization, you're supposed to kill yourself instead of be discovered. Whereas this is much more practical, hey, life is more important than this crazy religious dogma that is the Prime Directive. In a way, the Prime Directive is the religion of other episodes of Star Trek. And here, it's not. And I like that. I really enjoy the episode. I think it brings up a lot of good stuff. Picard is, really getting into his stride of being the center of morality for the show. And I would rate it as a 4.7.
Okay, Doc.
is the 4.7, is that related to the 47 in Trek?
Yeah, I think it's a factor of 10.
No,
I don't know. A 4.7? Doc, doesn't like half points.
Yeah, but that's different. That's just because I'm not able to distinguish very well between a 4.5 and a 5 or a 4. I've mentioned this before. The reason why I don't like it is that I think as humans, we're good at kind of giving an indication of whether we like it or not. And I also think we're good at ranking things. And very often when people have to come up with, they'll put something forward and say, I think this is like a 4, but it's not as good as that other 4 I gave. So it's more like a 3.9, or it's kind of better than another 4 I gave, so I'll call it a 4.1. So I think that's often why people fall into the points. But anyway, it really doesn't matter. To the extent that anyone wants to express it, any rating in terms of a decimal or a percentage, or even a, even an irrational number, that's fine by me.
Okay.
This episode was better than I remembered it being. I really enjoyed watching this. And I have mentioned in the past that I wasn't the biggest fan of Picard when I started watching TNG. I think he was too uptight. And in particular, I remember going into Best of Both Worlds, absolutely convinced that they would get rid of this horrendous captain that I didn't like and I didn't enjoy at all. But it's really, it's episodes like this that I think that show Picard at his best. So I was really impressed by how he plays it and how, as I mentioned in the show, how different he plays it than Kirk. And it's clearly a different age, but I really enjoy the storytelling in this episode. I also think that, behind the discussion that we've had, right, it's still a relatively exciting episode. They rush to a planet because some people are about to be discovered. Something bad happens. They have to go and rescue someone, and then they get caught up in a bit of a situation whereby someone has accidentally been convinced that someone else is God. And even watching as a child, you could, you know, you could still enjoy that aspect of the show. It's not like a boring courtroom drama kind of show that takes place on one level rather than on multiple levels. So I think they do very well in this episode. I like the Prime Directive, and as I was mentioning in the past, I like the way that it's interpreted as a let's do, you know, do no harm rather than a, you know, don't have any contact of any sort whatsoever. I really like this. I think I've got a higher opinion of this episode, haven't watched it this time, and also haven't spoken to you guys throughout the last couple of hours. I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5. It's a low 5. It's not a high 5, but it is a 5 nonetheless. I think it would be it's a couple above the kind of episode I'd give a 4 to. So that means a 5 for me.
Okay, 5 it is. So 4.5, 4.7, and a 5. All right, cool. So let's see, Data. I'm going to look up when you will be back. The High Ground, episode number 12.
Another banned in the UK. Not anymore, right?
No, not anymore, but it was for a very, very long time.
It was, yeah.
All right, that's looking like September 19th at 1 o'clock your time.
I hope that wasn't directed at me, because I don't want to be up at 1 o'clock.
I'm sure we'll work it out.
Yep, no, it's 9 o'clock your time, Doc.
Excellent.
9 o'clock, excellent. No, I don't want to do a show at 9 o'clock. But anyway, that's a different story.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Dr. Crusher, incoming wounded.
A young boy faces a tragic loss.
Your mother has died.
I'm all alone now, sir.
But are the dead coming back to life?
There's a presence on the Enterprise.
Mom?
Or is it an alien force at work?
Come, Jeremy.
Hey, wait, stop, no!
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
So join us next week as we review episode 5 of season 3, The Bonding. And we are slated to have Brian Detamore, our resident Klingon, for that one. So, Data, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
All right, and we will see you again. Thank you for downloading, and good night.
Good night. So why is Brian on for a non-Klingon episode?
For the bonding. It's about Worf. Well, it's about the boy, but yeah. Worf and the boy have to get together.
Yeah, but it's not exactly. I mean, from this season, you would have thought things like Sins of the Father, right? That's a Klingon episode. You get dressed up and you hit people with bat nets.
And he'll be on for Sins of the Father.
Okay.
Oh, no. See, here's the deal. I'm going to give you some secret sauce on this one. Brian gets a Klingon episode, hands down. If he wants them, he gets them. I mean, Brian's been with me since 2009, and I feel like I'm indebted to him for helping me get to where we are today. So he gets the Klingon episodes out of the gate. Just like Data. Data's going to be probably getting the Data episodes because it's just, you know, it makes perfect sense. So, however, if you don't want one, you don't have to do it. But I just assume you'd like the Data episodes.
I think we've lost Data.
Data. Oh, okay. Well, the thought was there at least. So anyway, but that's where I do the Klingon stuff. Okay, let's go on. All right, guys. And now, normally we would do a forum feedback, but Doc, technically, by the time we're recording this, Evolution just went out last week. So I don't think it's enough time either today or tomorrow to really get a good response on feedback, so I would like to hold that off until the bonding
things. Is today Evolution's feedback, or is today's actually the Ensigns of Command's feedback?
No, it was supposed to be. Oh, you're right, the Ensigns of Command. So
which is yet again, to post.
Which is yet to post. So yeah, we didn't even put that in. You're right. So. Okay, so normally, guys, we would have done some forum feedback, but since the season is so fresh, there's only been a couple episodes at this point that have actually been put out, I'd like to build up some more forum feedback before we start them. So we are going to start them next week for the bonding, if that's all right with you guys. Yeah, is it? Really? Kieran, you're all right? Cool. Thank you. No, lad. Get it on now. So don't worry, Kieran. You're going to hear what you had to say for ones like Evolution or the Ensigns of Command. So
when's Kieran on? He's on for the... He's on
Booby Trap.
He's Booby Trap. Yep.
Ah. He's Booby Trap. I am so looking forward to that. I think what I'm going to do is plow myself with lots of coffee and caffeine, and maybe I'm going to keep up with him because he talks fast and hard. I heard an episode. I'm like, whoa, what did you do to say? So, but that's okay. It's going to be a challenge. And I bet you anything, he's going to come on our show and talk real slow for Lou. What do you think?
Yeah, sure.
Probably. Anyway, we're looking forward to it. All right. Again, good night.
Good night.